It was neatly packed with tiny 22 shells, maybe 50 of them.
"Show me how to load it," she said.
He shook his head. "You should leave it out here," he said. "Just dump it and forget about it."
"But why?"
"Because this whole thing is crazy. Guns are dangerous, Carmen. You shouldn't keep one around Ellie. There might be an accident."
"I'll be very careful."
"And the house is full of guns anyway. Rifles are different. She's too small to reach the trigger and have it pointing at herself simultaneously."
"I keep it hidden. She hasn't found it yet."
"Only a matter of time." She shook her head.
"My decision," she said. "She's my daughter."
He said nothing.
"She won't find it," she said. "I keep it by the bed, and she doesn't come in there."
"What happens to her if you decide to use it?" She nodded.
"I know. I think about that all the time. I just hope she's too young to really understand. And when she's old enough, maybe she'll see it was the lesser of two evils."
"Now, what happens to her, there and then, when you're in jail?"
"They don't send you to jail for self-defense."
"Who says it's self-defense?"
"You know it would be self-defense."
"Doesn't matter what I know. I'm not the sheriff. I'm not the DA. I'm not the judge and jury." She went quiet.
"Think about it, Carmen," he said. "They'll arrest you. You'll be charged with first-degree homicide. You've got no bail money. You've got no money for a lawyer either, so you'll get a public defender. You'll be arraigned and you'll go to trial. Could be 6 or 9 months down the road. Could be a year. Then let's say everything goes exactly your way from that point on. The public defender makes out it's self-defense. The jury buys it. The judge apologizes that a wronged woman has been put through all of that. And you're back on the street. But that's a year from now, at least. What's Ellie been doing all that time?" She said nothing.
"She'll have spent a year with Rusty," he said, "on her own, because that's where the court would leave her. The grandmother? Ideal solution."
"Not when they understood what the Greers are like."
"Okay, so partway through the year, family services will arrive and haul her off to some foster home. Is that what you want for her?" She winced.
"Rusty would send her there anyway. She'd refuse to keep her if Sloop wasn't around anymore."
"So leave the gun out here in the desert. It's not a good idea." He handed it back to her. She took it and cradled it in her palms like it was a precious object. She tumbled it from one hand to another, like a child's game. The fake pearl grips flashed in the sun.
"No,"
she said.
"I want to learn to use it, for self-confidence. And that's a decision that's mine to make. You can't decide for me."
He was quiet for a beat, then he shrugged. "Okay," he said. "Your life. Your kid, your decision. But guns are serious business, so pay attention." She passed it back. He laid it flat on his left palm. It reached from the bowl of his thumb to the middle knuckle of his middle finger. "Two warnings," he said. "This is a very, very short barrel. See that?" He traced his right index finger from the chamber to the muzzle. 2.5 inches is all. Did they explain that at the store?" She nodded.
"The guy said it would fit real easy in my bag."
"It makes it a very inaccurate weapon," he said. "The longer the barrel, the straighter it shoots. That's why rifles are 3 feet long. If you're going to use this thing, you need to get very, very close, okay? Inches away would be best. right next to the target, touching the target if you can. You try to use this thing across a room, you'll miss by miles.
Okay,
she said. Second warning. He dug a bullet out of the box and held it up. This thing is tiny and slow. The pointy part is the bullet, and the rest of it is the powder in the shell case. Not a very big bullet, and not very much powder behind it, so it's not necessarily going to do a lot of damage. Worse than a bee sting, but one shot isn't going to be enough. So you need to get real close, and you need to keep on pulling the trigger until the gun is empty.
Okay,
she said again. Now watch. He clicked out the magazine and fed 9 bullets into it, clicked the magazine back in, and jacked the first shell into the breech, took out the magazine again and refilled the empty spot at the bottom, clicked it back in, and cocked the gun and left the safety catch on. Cocked and locked, he said. You do 2 things. Push the safety catch and pull the trigger 10 times. It'll fire 10 times before it's empty, because there's 1 already in the mechanism and 9 more in the magazine. He handed the gun to her. Don't point it at me, he said. Never point a loaded gun at anything you don't definitely want to kill. She took it and held it away from him cautiously. Try it, he told her. The safety and the trigger. She used her left hand to unlatch the safety. Then she pointed it in her right and closed her eyes and pulled the trigger. The gun twisted in her grip and pointed down. The blast of the shot sounded quiet out there in the emptiness. A chip of rock and a spurt of dust kicked off the floor 10 feet away. There was a metallic ricochet whang and a muted ring as the showcase ejected and the horses shuffled in place, and then silence closed in again.
Well, it works, she said.
Put the safety back on, he said. She clicked the catch, and he turned to look at the horses. He didn't want them to run, didn't want to spend time chasing them in the heat. But they were happy enough, standing quietly, watching warily. He turned back and undid his top button and slipped his shirt off over his head, walked 15 feet south and laid the shirt on the rim of the gulch, hanging it down and spreading it out to represent a man's torso. He walked back and stood behind her. Now shoot my shirt, he said. You always aim for the body because it's the biggest target and the most vulnerable. She raised the gun and then lowered it again.
I can't do this, she said. You don't want holes in your shirt.
I figure there isn't much of a risk, he said. Try it. She forgot to release the safety catch, just pulled on the unyielding trigger. Twice, puzzled why it wouldn't work. Then she remembered and clicked it off, pointed the gun and closed her eyes and fired. Reacher guessed she missed by 20 feet, high and wide. Keep your eyes open, he said. Pretend you're mad at the shirt. You're standing there pointing your finger right at it like you're yelling. She kept her eyes open, squared her shoulders, and pointed with her right arm held level. She fired and missed again, maybe 6 feet to the left, maybe a little low. Let me try, he said. She passed him the gun. It was tiny in his hand. The trigger guard was almost too small to fit his finger. He closed one eye and sighted in. I'm aiming for where the pocket was, he said. He fired a double tap, 2 shots in quick succession, with his hand rock steady. The first hit the shirt in the armpit, opposite the torn pocket. The second hit centrally, but low down. He relaxed his stance and handed the gun back. Your turn again, he said.
She fired three more, all of them hopeless misses, high to the right, wide to the left. The last hit the dirt, maybe 7 feet short of the target. She stared at the shirt and lowered the gun, disappointed.
"So what have you learned?" he asked.
"I need to get close," she said.
"Damn right," he said. "And it's not entirely your fault. A short barrel handgun is a close-up weapon. See what I did? I missed by 12 inches, from 15 feet. One bullet went left and the other went down. They didn't even miss consistently. And I can shoot. I won competitions for pistol shooting in the army. Couple of years, I was the best there was."
"Okay," she said.
He took the gun from her and squatted in the dust and reloaded it, one up the spout and 9 in the magazine. He cocked it and locked it and laid it on the ground.
"Leave it there," he said, "unless you're very, very sure. Could you do it?"
"I think so," she said.
"Thinking so isn't enough. You've got to know so. You've got to be prepared to get real close, jam it into his gut, and fire 10 times. If you don't, or if you hesitate, he'll take it away from you. Maybe turn it on you. Maybe fire wildly and hit Ellie running in from her room." She nodded quietly.
"Last resort."
"Believe it. You pull the gun from that point on, it's all or nothing." She nodded again.
"Your decision," he said. "But I suggest you leave it there."
She stood still for a long, long time. Then she bent down and picked up the gun, slipped it back into her bag. He walked over and retrieved his shirt and slipped it over his head. Neither bullet hole showed. One was under his arm, and the other tucked in below the waistband of his pants. Then he tracked around the gulch and picked up all 8 spent shell cases. It was an old habit, and good housekeeping. He jingled them together in his hand like small change, and put them in his trouser pocket. They talked about fear on the ride home. Carmen was quiet on the way back up the rise, and she stopped again at the peak. The Red House compound stretched below them in the distant haze, and she just sat and looked down at it, both hands clasped on the horn of her saddle, saying nothing, a faraway look in her eyes. Reacher's horse stopped, as usual, slightly behind hers, so he got the same view but framed by the curve of her neck and her shoulder.
"Do you ever get afraid?" she asked.
"No," he said.
She was quiet again for a spell.
"But how is that possible?"
she asked. He looked at the sky.
"It's something I learned when I was a little boy."
"How?"
He looked at the ground. "I had a brother, older than me, so he was always ahead, but I wanted to be doing the same stuff as him. He had scary comics, and anywhere we had American television, he'd be watching it. So I looked at the same comics and watched the same shows. There was one show about space adventures. I don't remember what it was called. We watched it in black and white somewhere. Maybe in Europe. They had a spaceship that looked like a little submarine with spider legs. They would land it somewhere and get out and go exploring. I remember one night they got chased by this scary creature. It was hairy, like an ape. Like Bigfoot. Long, hairy arms and a big snarl. It chased them back to the spaceship, and they jumped in and slammed the hatch shut just as it was climbing in after them."
"And you were scared?"
He nodded, even though he was behind her. "I was about 4, I think. I was terrified. That night,
I was certain the thing was under my bed. I had this high old bed, and I knew the thing was living under it. It was going to come out and get me. I could just about feel its paw reaching up for me. I couldn't sleep. If I went to sleep, it would come out and get me, for sure. So I stayed awake for hours. I would call for my dad, but when he came in, I was too ashamed to tell him. It went on like that for days and days.
And what happened?
I got mad. Not at myself for being afraid, because as far as I was concerned, the thing was totally real and I should be afraid. I got mad at the thing for making me afraid, for threatening me. One night, I just kind of exploded with fury. I yelled, "Okay, come out and try it. Just damn well try it. I'll beat the shit right out of you." I faced it down. I turned the fear into aggression.
And that worked?
I've never been scared since. It's a habit. Those space explorers shouldn't have turned and run, Carmen. They should have stood there and faced the creature down. They should have stood and fought. You see something scary, you should stand up and step toward it, not away from it. Instinctively, reflexively, in a raging fury.
Is that what you do?
Always.
Is it what I should do? With Sloop?
I think it's what everybody should do. She was quiet for a moment, just staring down at the house, and then lifting her eyes to the horizon beyond it. She clicked her tongue, and both horses moved off together, down the long, slow slope toward the road. She shifted in the saddle to keep her balance. Reacher imitated her posture and stayed safely aboard, but not comfortably. He figured horseback riding would be one of the things he tried once and didn't repeat.
"So what did Bobby say?"
she asked.
"About us?"
"He said you've been away most days for a month, and some nights, and he figured we've been up in a motel in Pecos together having an affair. Now he's all outraged that you brought me down here, so close to Sloop getting back."
"I wish we had been," she said, "in a motel, having an affair. I wish that was all it was."
He said nothing. She paused a beat.
"Do you wish we had been, too?" she asked.
He watched her in the saddle, lithe, slim, hips swaying gently against the patient gait of the horse. The dark, honey skin of her arms was bright in the sun. Her hair hung to the middle of her back. "I could think of worse things," he said. It was very late in the afternoon when they got back. Josh and Billy were waiting. They were leaning side by side against the wall of the barn in the harsh shadow below the eaves. Their pickup was ready for the trip to the feed supplier. It was parked in the yard.
"It takes all three of you?"
Carmen whispered. "It's Bobby," Reacher said back. "He's trying to keep me away from you, trying to spoil the fun we're supposed to be having." She rolled her eyes.
"I'll put the horses away," she said. "I should brush them first."
They dismounted together in front of the barn door. Josh and Billy peeled off the wall, impatience in their body language.
"You ready?"
Billy called.
"He should have been ready a half hour ago," Josh said.
For that, Reacher made them wait. He walked down to the bunkhouse very slowly, because he wasn't going to let them hurry him, and because he was stiff from the saddle. He used the bathroom and rinsed dust off his face, splashed cold water over his shirt, walked slowly back. The pickup had turned to face the gate, and the engine was running. Carmen was brushing his horse. Thin clouds of dust were coming off its chestnut fur. Hair? Coat? Josh was sitting sideways in the driver's seat. Billy was standing next to the passenger door. "So let's go," he called. He put Reacher in the middle seat. Josh swung his feet in and slammed his door shut. Billy crowded in on the other side, and Josh took off toward the gate, paused at the road, and then made a left, at which point Reacher knew the situation was a lot worse than he had guessed. 7. He had seen the feed bags in the storeroom. There were plenty of them, maybe 40, in head-high stacks. Big, waxed paper bags, probably 30 pounds to a bag. Altogether, 1,200 pounds of feed, about half a ton. How fast were 4 horses and a pony going to eat their way through all of that? But he had always understood the trip was Bobby's idea of a diversion. Buying more feed before it was strictly necessary was as good a way as any of getting him out of Carmen's life for a spell. But they weren't buying more feed, because they had turned left. The bags were all printed with a brand name and nutritional boasts, and the name and the address of the feed supplier. The feed supplier was in San Angelo. He had seen it repeated 40 times, once on each bag, in big, clear letters. San Angelo. San Angelo. San Angelo. And San Angelo was north and east of Echo County. Way north and east, not south and west. They should have turned right. So Bobby was planning to get him out of Carmen's life, permanently. Josh and Billy had been told to get rid of him. "And Josh and Billy will do what they're told," Bobby had said. He smiled at the windshield. "Forewarned is forearmed." They didn't know he had seen the feed bags, didn't know he'd read the writing on them, and they didn't know he'd been looking at maps of Texas for most of the last week. They didn't know a left turn instead of a right would mean anything to him. How would they aim to do it? Carmen had implied her out-of-work teacher friend had been scared off. Scared pretty badly, if he wouldn't even talk to her later, up in the relative safety of Pecos. So were they going to try to scare him? If so, they really had to be kidding. He felt the aggression building inside. He used it and controlled it like he had learned to. He used the adrenaline flow to ease the stiffness in his legs. He let it pump him up. He flexed his shoulders, leaning on Josh on one side, Billy on the other. "How far is it?" he asked innocently.
"Couple of hours," Billy said.
They were doing about 60, heading south on the dead straight road. The landscape was unchanging. Scrubby, dry grassland on the left, sullen limestone caliche on the right, broken up into ledges and layers, all of it baking under the relentless sun. There was no traffic. The road looked like it saw 1 or 2 vehicles a day. Maybe all they had to do was get far enough away, pull over, throw him out, and he'd die slowly of thirst before anybody got to him. Or of exhaustion, walking back. Or of rattlesnake bites.
"No, less than a couple of hours," Josh said. 100 miles is all.
So maybe they were headed to the bar they had mentioned yesterday. Maybe they had friends there.
They better had, Reacher thought. A pair of fifth-rate cowboys ain't going to do it for me.
Then he breathed out again, relaxed, struggled with a decision. The problem with the kind of undiluted, raging aggression he had described to Carmen was it came out so all or nothing. He recalled his first day in high school. The summer after he finished his elementary education, the family moved back stateside for a 6-month tour. He was enrolled in a big high school off base, somewhere in New Jersey, somewhere near Fort Dix. And he was ready for it. In his usual serious, earnest fashion, he calculated that high school would be bigger and better than elementary school in every way, including the seriousness of the locker room scuffling. So he made his usual new school first day plan to jump on the very first guy who tried anything. That had always worked well for him. Hit hard, hit early, get your retaliation in first. It made a big impression. But this time, make an even bigger impression. Hit harder than ever, because clearly high school was going to be a whole new kind of a deal. So sure enough, some hard kid shoved him the first morning, and 10 minutes later, the hard kid was on his way to the hospital for a 3-week stay. Then Reacher discovered it was really a very genteel school in a good neighborhood, and that he had reacted way too drastically, and everybody was looking at him like he was some sort of a barbarian. And he felt like one. He felt a little ashamed. From then on, he'd become calmer. He had learned to be certain what he was into before he did anything. And he had learned to offer warnings, sometimes, in certain circumstances. "We coming straight back?" he asked. It was a smart, tactical question. They couldn't say no without alerting him. They couldn't say yes if they weren't going there in the first place. "We're going for a couple beers first," Billy said.
"Where?"
"Where we went yesterday."
"I'm broke," Reacher said. "I didn't get paid yet."
"We're buying," Josh said.
"The feed store open late? On a Saturday?"
"Big order. They'll accommodate us," Billy said.
Maybe it was a new supplier. Maybe they changed their source. "I guess you use them a lot," he said.
"All the years we've been here," Josh said.
"Then we're going straight back?"
"Sure we are," Billy said. "You'll be back in time for your beauty sleep."
"That's good," Reacher said. He paused. "Because that's the way I like it," he said. "Mess with me now, you get what you get."
Billy said nothing. Josh just smiled and drove. The scenery flattened very gradually as they headed south. From his time with the maps, he knew the Rio Grande was curling around toward them from the west. They were entering the river basin, where wide, prehistoric waters had scoured the land. Josh kept the speed at a steady 60. Billy stared idly out of his window. The road remained straight and featureless. Reacher rested his head on the gun rack behind him and waited. Waiting was something he was accustomed to. Many times in his career, frantic action had been preceded by a long drive. It usually happened that way. The patient accumulation of evidence, the arrival at a conclusion, the identification of a suspect, the drive out to deal with him. Waiting was a skill you learned fast in the military. The road got rougher the farther south they drove. The truck labored over it. The load bed was empty, so the rear wheels bounced and skipped. There were vultures on some of the telephone poles. The sun was low in the west. There was a sign on the shoulder. It said, "Echo." 5 miles. It was pocked with bullet holes.
I thought Echo was north, Reacher said, where Ellie goes to school.
It's split, Billy said. Half of it up there, half of it down here. 160 miles of nothing in between.
World's biggest town, end to end, Josh said. Bigger than Los Angeles.
He eased off the gas around a long, slow curve, and a cluster of small buildings came into view in the distance, all of them built low to the ground, all of them lit from behind by the low sun. There were tin advertisements on the shoulder, 3 miles out, announcing well in advance what the buildings were going to be. There was going to be another gas station and a country store and a bar called the Longhorn Lounge, owned and operated by somebody named Harley. It had the last sign, but it was the first establishment they came to. It was 100 feet east of the shoulder of the road, built out of tarred boards under an iron roof, crouched low at an angle in the middle of 2 acres of parched earth. There were 10 or 12 pickup trucks parked nose into the building like airplanes at a terminal. And nearest the door was the sheriff's second-hand police car, just sitting there like it had been abandoned. Josh bumped across the parking lot and put the truck in line with the others. The bar had neon beer signs in the windows, trapped between dirty glass and faded gingham drapes. Josh turned the motor off, put the keys in his pocket. In the sudden quiet, Reacher could hear bar noise, the roar of extractor fans and air conditioners, the thump of an overworked jukebox amplifier, the rumble of talking, the chink of bottles and glasses, the click of pool balls. Sounded like a reasonable crowd in there. Josh and Billy opened their doors together and swung out. Reacher slid out through the passenger door and stood with his back to the sun. It was still hot. He could feel heat all over him, right from the back of his neck to the heels of his shoes.
Okay, Billy said. We're buying.
There was an inside lobby with an old-fashioned payphone and scrawled numbers and old messages creeping over the boards alongside it. Then there was a second door with a yellow glass window in it that led into the bar itself. Billy pushed it open. For a military cop, walking into a bar is like a batter stepping to the plate. It's his place of business. Maybe 90% of low-grade trouble in the service happens in bars. Put a bunch of young men trained for aggression and reaction alongside a limitless supply of alcohol, add in unit rivalries, add in the presence of civilian women and their civilian husbands and boyfriends, and it becomes inevitable. So just like a batter walks warily from the on-deck circle, watching the infield, surveying the outfield, calculating angles and distances, a military cop is all eyes on the way into a bar. First, he counts the exits. There are usually 3. The front door, the back door, out beyond the restrooms, and the private door from the office behind the bar. Reacher saw that the Longhorn Lounge had all 3 of them. The windows were too small to be useful to anybody. Then the MP looks at the crowd. He looks for knots of trouble. Who falls silent and stares? Where are the challenges? Nowhere in the Longhorn. There were maybe 20 or 25 people in the long, low room, all men, all tanned and lean and dressed in denim, none of them paying any kind of attention beyond casual glances and nods of easy familiarity toward Billy and Josh. The sheriff was nowhere to be seen.
But there was an unoccupied stool at the bar, with a fresh bottle sitting on a used napkin in front of it. Maybe the place of honor. Then the MP looks for weapons. There was an antique revolver above the bar, wired onto a wooden plaque with a message branded into it with a hot poker. We don't call 911. There would be a few modern handguns here and there in the room. There were long-neck bottles all over the place, but Reacher wasn't worried about them. Bottles are no real use as weapons, except in the movies, where they make them out of sponge sugar and print the labels on tissue paper. A real bottle won't break against a tabletop. The glass is too thick. They just make a loud, banging noise. They have some marginal use as clubs, but the pool table worried him more. It sat in the middle of the room, all covered in hard celluloid balls. Four guys with four cues using it, maybe a dozen more cues vertical in a long rack on the nearest wall. Short of a shotgun, a pool cue is the best barroom weapon ever invented. Short enough to be handy, long enough to be useful, made out of fine hardwood and nicely weighted with lead. The air was unnaturally cold and thick with beer fumes and smoke and noise. The jukebox was near the pool table, and beyond it was an area with small, round lounge tables surrounded by stools padded with red vinyl. Billy held up three fingers to the barman and got three cold bottles in exchange. He carried them laced between his fingers and led the way toward the tables. Reacher stepped ahead of him and got there first. He wanted his choice of seats. Back to the wall was his rule. All three exits in view, if possible. He threaded his way in and sat down. Josh sat to his half-right, and Billy sat half-left. Pushed a bottle across the scarred surface of the table. People had stubbed cigarettes on the wood. The sheriff came into the room from the rear, from the direction of the restrooms, checking that his pants were zipped. He paused a second when he saw Reacher. Nothing in his face, and then he moved on and sat down at the bar on the unoccupied stool, his shoulders hunched, his back to the crowd. Billy raised his bottle like a toast.
Good luck, he said.
You're going to need it, pal, Reacher thought. He took a long pull from his own bottle. The beer was cold and gassy. It tasted strongly of hops.
I need to make a phone call, Billy said.
He pushed back from the table and stood up again. Josh leaned to his right, trying to fill the new vacant space in front of Reacher. Billy made it through the crowd and went outside to the lobby. Reacher took another sip of his beer and estimated the passage of time, and counted the people in the room. There were 23 of them. Excluding himself, including the barman, who he guessed was Harley. Billy came back inside 2 minutes and 40 seconds. He bent and spoke into the sheriff's ear. The sheriff nodded. Billy spoke some more. The sheriff nodded again. Drained his bottle and pushed back from the bar and stood up. Turned to face the room. Glanced once in Reacher's direction, and then stepped away and pushed out through the door. Billy stood and watched him go, and then threaded his way back to the table.
"Sheriff's leaving," he said. He remembered he had urgent business elsewhere.
Reacher said nothing.
"Did you make your call?" Josh asked, like it was rehearsed.
"Yes, I made my call," Billy said.
Then he sat down on his stool and picked up his bottle.
"Don't you want to know who I called?"
he said, looking across at Reacher.
Why would I give a rat's ass who you called? Reacher said.
I called for the ambulance, Billy said. Best to do it ahead of time, because it comes all the way from Presidio. It can take hours to get here.
See, we got a confession to make, Josh said. We lied to you before. There was a guy we ran off. He was knocking boots with the Mexican woman. Bobby didn't think that was appropriate behavior in the circumstances, what with Sloop being in prison and all. So we got asked to take care of it. We brought him down here.
Want to know what we did? Billy asked.
I thought we were going to the feed store, Reacher said.
Feed store's up in San Angelo.
So what are we doing all the way down here?
We're telling you, is what? This is where we brought the other guy.
What's this other guy got to do with me?
Bobby figures you're in the same category as what?
He thinks I'm knocking boots with her, too? Josh nodded.
He sure does.
What do you think?
We agree with him. Why else would you come around? You're no horseman, that's for damn sure.
Suppose I told you we're just good friends.
Bobby says you're more than that.
And you believe him? Billy nodded.
Sure we do. She comes on to him. He told us that himself, so why should you be any different? And hey, we don't blame you. She's a good-looking piece of ass. I'd go there myself, except she Sloop's. You gotta respect family, even with Beaners. That's the rule around here.
Reacher said nothing.
Her other guy was a school teacher, Billy said. Got way out of line. So we brought him down here, and we took him out back in the yard, and we got us a hog butchering knife, and we got us a couple of guys to hold him, and we pulled his pants down, and we told him we were going to cut it off. He was all crying and whimpering and messing himself, begging and whining, promising he'd get himself lost, pleading with us not to cut. But we cut just a little, anyway, for the fun of it. There's blood everywhere. Then we let him go. But we told him if we ever saw his face again, we'd take it all the way off, for real. And you know what? We never saw his face again.
So it worked, Josh said. It worked real good. Only problem was he nearly bled out from the wound. We should have called ahead for the ambulance. We figured we should remember that for the next time. Live and learn, that's what we always say. So this time we did call ahead, especially for you. So you should be grateful.
You cut the guy? Reacher asked.
We sure did.
Sounds like you're real proud of yourselves.
We do what it takes. We look after the family.
And you're admitting it to me.
Josh nodded.
Why shouldn't we? Like, who the hell are you?
Reacher shrugged.
Well, I'm not a school teacher.
What's that supposed to mean?
It means you aim to cut me? It'll be you goes in the ambulance.
You think?
Reacher nodded. That horse I was on shit more trouble than you guys are going to give me.
He looked at each of them in turn, openly and evenly. Serene self-confidence works wonders in a situation like that, and he felt confident.
It was confidence born of experience. It was a long, long time since he had lost a two-on-one bar fight.
"Your choice," he said. "Quit now, or go to the hospital."
"Well, you know what,"
Josh said, smiling.
"I think we'll stay with the program, because whatever the hell kind of a guy you think you are, we're the ones got a lot of friends in here, and you don't."
"I didn't inquire about your social situation," Reacher said. But it was clearly true. They had friends in there. Some kind of a subliminal vibe was quieting the room, making people restless and watchful. They were glancing over, then glancing at each other. The atmosphere was building. The pool game was slowing down. Reacher could feel tension in the air. The silences were starting, the challenges. Maybe it was going to be worse than two-on-one. Maybe a lot worse. Billy smiled.
"We don't scare easy," he said. "Call it a professional thing."
"They get in the ring with bulls that weigh a ton and a half," Bobby had said. "They ain't going to be too worried about you." Reacher had never been to a rodeo. He knew nothing about them, except for occasional passing impressions from television or the movies. He guessed the riders sat on some kind of a fence near the pen, and they jumped on just as the bull was released out into the ring. Then they had to stay on. What was it, 8 seconds? And if they didn't, they could get kicked around pretty badly. They could get stomped or gored with the horns. So these guys had some kind of dumb courage and strength and resilience, and they were accustomed to pain and injury. But they were also accustomed to some kind of a pattern, some kind of a structured build-up, some kind of a measured countdown before the action suddenly started. He didn't know for sure how it went. Maybe 3, 2, 1, go. Maybe 10, 9, 8, whatever. They were accustomed to waiting, counting off the seconds, tensing up, breathing deeply, getting ready for it.
"So let's do it," he said. "Right now, in the yard."
He came out from behind the table and stepped past Josh before he could react. Walked ahead, away from the jukebox, to the right of the pool table, heading for the restroom exit. Knots of people blocked him, and then parted to let him through. He heard Josh and Billy following right behind him. He felt them counting down, tensing up, getting ready. Maybe 20 paces to the exit, maybe 30 seconds to the yard.
29, 28.
He kept his steps even, building on the rhythm. 27, 26, arms loose by his side. 25, 24. He snatched the last pool cue from the rack and reversed it in his hands and scythed the complete 180-degree turn and hit Billy as hard as he could in the side of the head. 1. There was a loud crunch of bone, clearly audible over the jukebox noise, and a spray of blood, and Billy went down like he had been machine-gunned. He swung again, chopping full force at Josh like a slugger swinging for the fences. 2. Josh's hand came up to block the blow, and his forearm broke clean in half. He screamed, and Richard swung again for the head. 3. Connecting hard, knocking him sideways. He jabbed for the face and punched out a couple of teeth. 4. Backhanded the cue with all his strength against the upper arm and shattered the bone. 5. Josh went down head to toe with Billy, and Reacher stood over them, both, and swung again 4 more times, fast and hard. 6, 7,
8, 9, against ribs and collarbones and knees and skulls. A total of 9 swings, maybe 6 or 7 seconds of furious, explosive force. Hit hard, hit early, get your retaliation in first, while they're still waiting for the bell. The other men in the bar had spun away from the action, and now they were crowding back in again, slowly and warily. Richard turned a menacing circle with the cue held ready. He bent and took the truck keys from Josh's pocket. Then he dropped the cue and let it clatter to the floor and barged his way through the crowd to the door, breathing hard, shoving people out of his way. Nobody seriously tried to stop him. Clearly, friendship had its limits down there in Echo County. He made it into the lot, still breathing fast. The heat broke him out in a sweat instantly. He made it back to the truck, slid inside and fired it up and backed away from the building and peeled away north. The bar door stayed firmly closed. Nobody came after him. The sun set far away in the west an hour into his drive back, and it was full dark when he turned in under the ranch gate. But every light in the red house was burning, and there were 2 cars parked in the yard. One was the sheriff's second-hand cruiser. The other was a lime-green Lincoln. The sheriff's car was flashing red and blue. The Lincoln was lit by the spill from the porch, and the hot yellow light made it look the color of a dead man's skin. There were clouds of moths everywhere, big, papery insects crowding the bulbs above the porch like tiny individual snowstorms, forming and reforming as they fluttered from one to the next. Behind them, the chant of the night insects was already rhythmic and insistent. The front door of the house was standing open, and there was noise in the foyer. Loud, excited conversation from a small crowd of people. Richard stepped up and looked into the room and saw the sheriff and Rusty Greer and Bobby and then Carmen standing alone near the rack of rifles. She had changed out of her jeans and shirt. She was wearing a dress. It was red and black and had no sleeves. It finished at the knee. She looked numb. Conflicting emotions in her face made it blank and expressionless. There was a man in a suit at the opposite end of the room, standing near the red-framed mirror, so Reacher could see the front and back of him at the same time. The Lincoln driver, obviously. He was sleek and slightly overweight, not short, not tall, dressed in pressed seersucker. Maybe 30 years old, with light-colored hair carefully combed and receding from a domed brow. He had a pale indoor face, red with sunburn on the upward-facing planes, like he played golf in the early afternoon. The face was split into a huge politician's smile. He looked like he had been receiving fulsome accolades and pretending they were completely unnecessary. Reacher paused on the porch and decided not to enter, but his weight put a loud creak into the boards, and Bobby heard it. He glanced out into the night and did a perfect double-take, stood completely still for a second, and then came hurrying through the door, took Reacher's elbow and pulled him into the lee of the wall alongside the entrance, out of sight of the foyer.
"What are you doing here?" he asked.
"I work here," Reacher said.
"Remember? Where are Josh and Billy?"
"They quit." Bobby stared at him.
"They what?"
"They quit," Reacher said again.
"What does that mean?"
"It means they decided they didn't want to work here anymore."
"Why would they do that?"
Reacher shrugged.
"How would I know?
Maybe they were just exercising their prerogative inside a free labor market.
What?
Reacher said nothing. Bobby's absence and the voices on the porch had pulled people to the door. Rusty Greer was first out, followed by the sheriff and the guy in the seersucker suit. Carmen stayed inside, near the rifles, still looking numb. They all fell silent, looking at Reacher. Rusty, like she had a social difficulty to deal with, the sheriff, puzzled, the new guy in the suit, wondering who the hell this stranger was.
What's going on? Rusty asked.
This guy says Josh and Billy quit on us, Bobby said.
They wouldn't do that,
Rusty said.
Why would they do that?
The guy in the suit was looming forward like he expected to be introduced.
Did they give a reason?
Rusty asked. The sheriff was looking straight at Reacher, nothing in his face. Reacher made no reply, just stood there waiting.
Well, I'm Hack Walker, the guy in the suit said, in a big, honest voice, holding out his hand. I'm the DA up in Pecos, and I'm a friend of the family.
Sloop's oldest friend,
Rusty said, absently. Reacher nodded and took the guy's hand. Jack Reacher, he said. I work here. The guy held on to his hand in both of his own and beamed a subtle little smile that was partly genuine, partly, you know how it is, ironic. A perfect politician's smile.
You registered to vote here yet?
He asked. Because if so, I just want to point out I'm running for judge in November, and I'd surely like to count on your support. Then he started up with a self-deprecating chuckle, a man secure among friends, amused about how the demands of democracy can intrude on good manners. You know how it is. Reacher took his hand back and nodded without speaking.
Hacks worked so hard for us,
Rusty said.
And now, he's brought us the most delightful news.
Al Eugene showed up? Reacher asked.
No, not yet,
Rusty said.
Something else, entirely.
And nothing to do with the election, Hack said. You folks all understand that, don't you? I agree. November time makes us want to do something for everybody, but you know I'd have done this for you anyhow.
And you know we'd all vote for you anyhow, Hack,
Rusty said. Then everybody started beaming at everybody else. Reacher glanced beyond them at Carmen, standing alone in the foyer. She wasn't beaming.
You're getting Sloop out early? He said. Tomorrow, I guess.
Hack Walker ducked his head like Reacher had offered him a compliment.
That's for sure, he said. All along they claimed they couldn't do administration on the weekend, but I managed to change their minds. They said it would be the first Sunday release in the history of the system. But I just said, hey, there's a first time for everything.
Hack's going to drive us up there,
Rusty said. We're leaving soon. We're going to drive all night.
We're going to be waiting on the sidewalk, Hack said, right outside the prison gate, 7 o'clock in the morning. Old Sloop's going to get a big welcome.
You all going? Reacher asked.
I'm not,
Carmen said. She had come out onto the porch, quietly. Like a wraith. She was standing with her feet together, both hands on the railing, leaning forward from the waist, elbows locked, staring north at the black horizon.
I have to stay and see to Ellie, she said.
Plenty of room in the car, Hack said. Ellie can come too.
Carmen shook her head.
I don't want her to see her father walking out of a prison door. Well, please yourself, Rusty said. He's only your husband, after all.
Carmen made no reply, just shivered slightly.